Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more of America This Week, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129. Welcome back to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Thanks for staying with us. I'm Kevin Clark. I'm here with Tim Reedy. You're listening to America This Week. And if you want to join our conversation with Senator George Mitchell, you can give us a ring at 888-322-8465. That's 1-888-3-CATHOLIC. We're speaking with Senator George Mitchell of Maine, who has been perhaps one of the most experienced American negotiators in the Middle East. You're describing some of the frustrations, some of the roadblocks, some of the obstacles to successful negotiations for the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. How do you keep a sense of hope? It seems like in your book you still a lot of people would say, you know what, this is never going to happen, not in our lifetimes. You still seem to have a personal sense of hope that we can resolve this.
I do. I've said many times publicly that I don't think there's anything such as a conflict that can't be ended. They're created by humans, they're conducted and sustained by humans for human purposes, and so they can be ended. Much of what is said about the Middle East being impossible and intractable was said about Northern Ireland. Mm-hmm. I was told hundreds of times over there, oh, Senator, we appreciate what you're doing, but you're wasting your time. One woman who looked like everybody's favorite grandmother said to me, we've been killing each other for centuries and we're going to keep killing each other long after you've gone back home. But it happened. Now, it's a very different situation. It's much more complex in the Middle East. I spoke to a large group of Irish Americans out in Queens a while ago, and I said to them that I'm about to express a thought that I never thought I would hold, let alone say. It is that I spent 5 years in Northern Ireland dealing with the Unionists and the Nationalists and with the British and the Irish, and I thought it was really, really tough. Then I spent 6 months with the Israelis and the Arabs, and now I think the Irish are a bunch of patsies. Really easy to deal with, friendly guys. So it's all relative. It's much tougher.
Yeah, you didn't meet my family in Ireland, apparently.
No, well, there are still some tough feelings, but I did two tours of duty in the Middle East, and it's changing. The events in the region are dramatic. Attitudes are changing, some for the better, some for the worse. Islam is undergoing a tremendous internal conflict on many levels, not just the Sunni-Shia split, which, of course, began on the death of the Prophet Muhammad, but many other internal divisions that arise from the artificial political order that was established after the First World War, primarily by the British and the French, acting in their own interests, not in the interests of the people of the region. And so having a collapsing political order and moving to a new one means an interim period, certainly of decades, that there will be violence, upheaval. There'll be some successes, some steps forward, many failures and some steps backward. History's quite clear that the overthrow of a poor government, a totalitarian government, a despotic government, by force or otherwise, does not guarantee something better in its place. Think of the Russians under the Tsars and then under Stalin and the Soviets. Look at what's happened in Libya. Look at what's happening in Syria. These are very difficult circumstances, and they all impact on the Israeli-Palestinian issue and vice versa. So it's going to be a tough period for time to come, but as the United States is the dominant power and will be for as far into the future as human beings can see, we will necessarily play a significant role in the resolution of this conflict. And I think to do that, you have to be hopeful, you have to be optimistic, yeah, not to be unrealistic or fanciful, but to identify the possible positives. The positions have changed over the past few decades. Attitudes have changed, as I said, some for the better, some for the worse, and so you have to capitalize on whatever openings there are. But if you listen long enough and hard enough, you can find common ground pretty much anywhere, and that's what I did in Northern Ireland.
You mentioned in your book that despite the rhetoric, it's and almost reluctantly, it seems like the Israelis are moving closer to the Palestinian position.
Yes.
And can you elaborate a little bit on that? What do you see happening, and where do you think it's going? I mean, because all we hear here are more settlements. It seems like more encroachments on the West Bank, more radicalization in Gaza, perhaps even now on the West Bank.
Well, I wouldn't say the Israelis are moving more toward the Palestinian position. I think that the world has moved more toward the Palestinian position over time. We point out that in 1982, President Reagan proposed a plan which was essentially not a Palestinian state. He was quite specific. He did not favor a Palestinian state. He favored Palestinian autonomy under Jordanian sovereignty. Prime Minister Begin categorically rejected it. Any diminution of Israeli authority over the West Bank was anathema to Begin and his party at the time. He could not have foreseen that within just a few years the United States would adopt as its policy the creation of a Palestinian state, articulated now by two Republican presidents, possibly a third along the way. And now the concept of a Palestinian state is not only something ephemeral or unreal, 137 countries in the world recognize it.
Including the Holy See.
The Holy See, yes. Yeah. So it's been a dramatic shift in international opinion in that regard. There are many others that operate both ways. The Palestinians have launched an international campaign to try to achieve statehood, not through negotiations with Israel, but through international recognition. Mm-hmm. And they've been successful in that campaign, but in my judgment, it moves them more toward a nominal state as opposed to a real state. And I think what matters is on the ground the way people live in their daily lives. The Israelis, meanwhile, are now trying to play catch-up with American help to establish themselves more in international communities. The United States has assisted them. I was deeply involved in their entry into the Organization for Economic Growth and Development, an essentially European group. We're going to help them in defense issues as well. In my book, I recommend that the United States help them because security is their primary concern. And the more they can feel secure and enhanced, I believe the more likely they are to be willing to consent to the existence of a Palestinian state next door.
Now, Kevin asked a question about kind of how do you keep hope in this process, and articulate answer. But I wonder, since we're on the Catholic Channel, you could speak to a little bit about your own Catholic background and how that shapes your approach to these very difficult situations.
My mother was born in Lebanon, a Maronite Catholic. Maron was a Lebanese monk who lived in the 5th century. It became a church, joined with the Roman Catholic Church about 500 years ago, and has since been described as the Eastern Catholic Rite. It's well established in the United States, as you know. There's the eparchy, what we would call the diocese, is based in Brooklyn for the East Coast, and there's another that covers the other parts of the country. My mother was deeply and profoundly religious. She went to Mass every day that she could. And I've said in my memoir that she lived the gospel. She didn't just listen to it and read it. She lived it. She was the personification of charity and love and welcoming for others. So I grew up with a mother who was devoutly religious. My father was the orphan son of Irish immigrants. He too was he was a Roman Catholic, but he was raised in an adopted household of Lebanese Maronite Catholics. So he was raised in as a Maronite. I went to parochial school. I was taught by Ursuline nuns for the first 6 years of my education. So it has been an important factor in my life. I've been exposed to other religions. I was divorced, and my first wife passed away. I remarried. My wife is Episcopal. So we go to an Episcopal church. I go also to a Catholic church. My son went to a Jesuit high school here in Manhattan, and he now attends a Jesuit university at Georgetown. So we have a long and largely, in my judgment, positive relationship. But it has meant a lot to me. Now, when I was first asked by President Clinton to go to Northern Ireland, the fact that I was a Catholic was deemed as a liability by some on the other side. Actually, it was Catholic, strike one, American, strike two, Democrat, strike three, you're out. So some had...
Even Ian Paisley comes around eventually.
He did. Well, they did. Yeah. We ended up as good friends. They first opposed me. And in a funny story, it was difficult for me to get seated. They were opposed. And when I entered the talks, after 2 days listening to discussion of my fitness for the position, Dr. Paisley walked out. And another small party affiliated with his walked out. Literally at 1:30 in the morning, they left in protest at my being seated as chairman. So after the meeting, I called them up. I set a meeting for later the same day. And they came back. And they said to me, well, we're coming back, but we really don't recognize you as chairman. I said, well, as long as you're back and talking, that's okay with me. But they said, we're not going to refer to you as chairman. I said, you're not? I said, what are you going to refer to me as? They said, senator. I said, well, I've been called worse. Not so bad. So we started out on a somewhat hostile relationship. But one of the benefits of a long process was that I'd been a federal judge. I had had some experience in how to conduct a proceeding in a fair way. And I did that over time. And toward the end of it, we were all friends. All of us now, buddies. Every time I see him, it's like Velcro. We have pictures taken together. So you persevere, and you try to get people to see others. I'm repeating this, what I said earlier, not as alien members of a hostile tribe, but as fellow human beings with the same hopes, fears that people have universally. I once got them, we were at a delicate stage in one of the series of discussions we had, and the two leaders at the time were Gerry Adams with Sinn Féin and David Trimble as head of the Union Party. They came to me and said, we can't possibly reach agreement because there's so much press. There was outside the building, there was a huge press contingent. Every night, television shows, newspapers, you know, oh, Mr. Trimble, you'd never agree to this, would you? Oh, you'd never agree to that. And look at what he said about you, and just stirring as if they said, we have to go someplace where we have privacy. After a while, I got the U.S. Ambassador's residence in London, which had been newly renovated, a beautiful building on lovely grounds. And so we went there, and we escaped from the press for about a week. And when we sat down for the first dinner, I said, now look, this is different. You guys, you're not going to all on one side and all on the other. I want everybody to mix up. And I said, I want no discussion of the issues. They said, well, what are we going to talk about? I said, talk about your family, your kids, your dog, where you go on vacations, a thing that normal human beings talk about when they get together. They don't talk about ending a war. They talk about life, the living, not killing. And so, it broke it down a little bit. They all knew that they were fellow human beings. But when you can get them thinking and acting and talking as though the other side is human and maybe they've got a point, then you've made the first step toward progress.
Yeah, and yet you haven't been able to do that in the Middle East, it seems.
Not yet, but we got to keep working at it.
Was that why you think Camp David, getting people out of the region to negotiate, helped tremendously?
Oh, it's a critical factor, yes. It's very, very hard. As I said, the building that we conducted negotiations in Northern Ireland was a British government office compound, series of buildings near the Northern Ireland Parliament building. And there was a fence. There were British troops all around. We were safe and secure. But just outside, there was a press compound. And the delegates, they'd drive to work. And they'd get out the car in the parking lot, and they'd have to walk through the gate. And there they had television crews and reporters and all of it stirring it up. Obviously, controversy is news. Good news isn't news. You're both in the business. I digress and tell a humorous story.
We try to spread the good news a little bit.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. I was a Senate Majority Leader, and I was one of the principal authors of Clean Air Act of 1990. And it was a terrific struggle. 2 years. Oh, endless issues, complicated, hard to deal with. And we got about 98% through. And the Washington Post ran a story that was all about the 2% that we hadn't agreed on yet. So I confronted the reporter in a nice way. I said, gee, you know, we got a lot done on this. You didn't deserve to be in paragraph 36. It should have been right up front. And he said to me, Senator, he said, you have never seen a headline in the Washington Post that reads, 2 million commuters made it safely to work today. He said, you'll see many headlines that say 6 people killed in a crash out on the interstate. Yeah. He said, what you're saying isn't news. And it's true. And it's even more true now than it was then.
Well, see, now getting 98% agreement in Congress would be news.
Yeah, it so would. Yeah. Getting 58 would be news. Yeah.
Again, we've been talking with Senator George Mitchell. His book is A Path to Peace, A Brief History of Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations and A Way Forward in the Middle East. Senator Mitchell, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
It's really been a privilege. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, we'll have our retiring
former Word columnist,
John Martins, coming in to talk about what it's been like to write that column for 3 years. You're listening to America This Week. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to hear the full show every week, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.